This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. La Crosse County voters go to the polls on Tuesday, April 7th, to select a new circuit court judge to represent Branch 5. The two vying for the seat are candidates Gloria Doyle and Brian Barton. We invited them into our studios to discuss their positions on local criminal justice issues. During the course of this forum, each candidate will be allowed a one-minute opening statement and, similarly, a one-minute closing statement. And during the rest of the conversation, each will be allowed up to 1.5 minutes to answer each question. They'll also have an opportunity for a brief rebuttal period and a chance to ask each other a question. A coin flip by our moderator, WPR's John Davis, and one by Gloria Doyle just prior to the conversation, determined the order of the candidate's opening statements. She chose to go second, and so we begin with Brian Barton.
Thank you. The next judge for La Crosse County Circuit Court Branch 5 will have to have knowledge in many areas of the law, but due to the fact that over 90% of the cases that the judges here in La Crosse County are criminal in nature, the judge will have to have extensive practical experience in criminal law. Throughout my career, I've handled family law, estate planning, real estate, and civil litigation. But what sets me apart is that I've practiced criminal defense for over five years and was an assistant and deputy district attorney for over 7 years. I've handled thousands of criminal cases, including homicides, drug cases, and other violent crimes. I was a charter member of the ODBI court, of the veterans court, and a member of our drug court. I have fought for the rights of victims and the rights of the accused. I know what sentencing options are available to our judges. I know how to best allocate our limited resources in each individual case, and I will do whatever I can to uphold the office and represent La Crosse County.
All right, thank you, Brian. And an opening statement from Gloria Doyle.
Well, thank you to you and your listeners for this opportunity to speak with the voters. I am Gloria Doyle, and I am currently your Family Court Commissioner for La Crosse County. I've been doing that for the last 9 years, and that is a quasi-judicial position where I handle all the family law matters, as well as the restraining orders and the child support calendar, paternity calendar, for all five branches of La Crosse County Circuit Courts. Anything the Family Court Commissioner does can be de novo to the judge, and I'm looking to run, therefore, and win the Branch 5 seat. I have also a broad base of legal experience, 18 years in private practice, in addition to my 9 years on the bench. And I've also practiced criminal law, guardianships, termination of parental rights, adoptions, family law, of course, as well as doing the restraining orders, civil law, including personal injury. So I have the skills to handle each and every one of those types of cases when I take the bench. The fact that I've focused and become an expert for the last 9 years does not mean that I have not previously had the experience of dealing with all sorts of different types of cases. I've also had the ability to sit in on the judges' meetings for the last 9 years and learn from my colleagues what's important to the constituents of this county.
All right. Thank you very much, Gloria. The first question is to Gloria Doyle. What is your judicial philosophy? In other words, what will your approach to the day-to-day job requirements of a judge be?
I don't think my judicial philosophy will change from what I've been doing as family court commissioner to what I would be doing as judge, and I think it is to listen carefully to everyone that comes before me, to weigh the facts before me as well as the law which applies, and to deal with everybody with a compassionate, knowledgeable, and calm demeanor. I think I've successfully done that as family court commissioner in an area which is very difficult, very high emotion, and very important to every litigant that comes before me. I think I've earned the respect of the attorneys who come before me, as well as the litigants, and I have a great deal of support within the legal community.
Same question for you, Brian Barton. What is your judicial philosophy?
Sure. Well, my judicial philosophy is that each judge should be impartial, unbiased, and balanced. They should follow the rule of law, no matter what their personal preferences are. They should follow the statutes and the Constitution, no matter what their personal preferences are. They should hold each individual the same, treat every individual as an individual with respect and dignity, to listen to the facts and to make a conclusion, a decision based upon the facts and as applied to the law.
This notion of fair and impartial, you hear that often in judicial races. What does that mean to you? And we'll start with Brian.
Fair and impartial, I think, you know, from my standpoint, you know, I've been a prosecutor and I've been a criminal defense attorney. You have to be able to listen to the facts no matter who's giving those facts. You have to, if it's law enforcement, you have to listen to what they have to say, but you have to understand that they are just an individual like everybody else. Excuse me. You can't go into any case with any preconceived notion. You have to be entirely unbiased and take every case as it comes by the facts.
Thank you. Gloria Doyle.
Well, I think fair and impartial means that regardless of who you're listening to, you're making sure that you excuse me, put that information into context within the case. As family court commissioner, just as for the judges, many individuals are now coming before the courts pro se or self-represented litigants, even though they may not have the same resources and be able to navigate the legal process as well as an attorney. They probably have the ability to state the facts just as well as anyone who is represented by an attorney. So I think you need to be able to listen to what each pro se or represented litigant has to say and weigh those with equal value. Also in my work as family court commissioner, we get expert witnesses, and I think it's important that you're weighing the testimony of each of the expert witnesses based on what they're bringing before you and not taking into consideration necessarily what personal relationship or information you may have on those individuals before they come into court, but listening to their testimony and assuring yourselves of their qualifications to speak to the issues before you.
This question is to you first. Gloria, the vast majority of cases in La Crosse County are criminal in nature. I think I've heard like 90%, something like that. How do you weigh the need to protect the community against the often strained conditions that there are in other parts of the criminal justice system, like an overcrowded state prison system or a crowded jail system if we're talking about a case that is a misdemeanor case?
If we're talking about a case that's a misdemeanor case, many times I don't think you're really looking at the overcrowding in the state prison system, depending on whether it's a person that's committed multiple misdemeanors or if it's their first-time offense. We have in La Crosse County the Criminal Justice Management Council, and I think they've done some great work at looking at what the best way to rehabilitate and punish these individuals would be over time. One of the things the Criminal Justice Management Council has made clear to the community, whether it's the judiciary or law enforcement or other parts of the community, after actually getting input from the community, is that we should rehabilitate those and/or punish the people that we're concerned about and incarcerate those individuals who are a danger to our community. So some of the people who commit misdemeanors, which is what you were talking about, may not be a danger to our community. They may simply be people that have alcohol and other drug issues or other family issues that have led them to commit these misdemeanors, and there's a possibility of rehabilitating them and getting them back on the road to being productive members of our society.
Same question to you, Brian Barton.
The first goal is obviously public protection, protection of the public. That has to be paramount no matter what, excuse me, what decision a judge renders. However, we've learned a lot over the years with regard to how to effectively sentence somebody. The old notion that you can lock somebody up or you should lock everybody up that commits a crime has not only proven to be ineffective, both cost-wise and for reoffending, but we've learned to use what resources we have, community resources, in order to identify which individuals we should focus rehabilitation on, which individuals we should focus retribution on, and retaliation. So I think that we have a good system in La Crosse County where we look at those items and look at those issues to determine how to best allocate those resources. I don't think we can lock everyone up. I don't think we should lock everyone up. The ones that we do lock up should be a danger that we see as a danger and are afraid of.
We're going to take a brief rebuttal period right now. We'll start with you, Brian. Would you like to either challenge anything that Gloria has said so far or clarify anything that you've said or talk about your candidacy at all? And you'll have a minute for that.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think there's anything that I've said that would need to be clarified, I guess. And as far as anything that Ms. Doyle stated, I don't have any comment on that.
Okay, very good. Gloria, rebuttal period?
Well, in terms of talking about my candidacy, I certainly want to make sure that the voters understand that I have judicial experience, that I've served with integrity, and that I have the ability to be decisive. In terms of rebuttals, I've seen a few letters go out in Brian's fundraising and other letters indicating that I have no criminal experience. And so I want to make sure that the voters understand if they get that type of mail, it's simply not true. In fact, I talked to the sheriff who endorsed Brian afterwards, and he apologized for the rancor that was found in his letter. Apparently, he said he signed that letter before it was written and never saw what was actually in it. So to those people that got that letter, don't believe everything you read that's coming from that campaign.
You want to respond to that, Brian?
I don't think that there was anything that came from me that indicated that in the primary or in this general election that either one of the opponents never had criminal experience. So
there's a letter from Dan Kopanky which says just that.
Okay. You're listening to an election forum with the judicial candidates for the La Crosse County Circuit Court position on the April 7th ballot in La Crosse County, Gloria Doyle and Brian Barton. The moderator is WPR's John Davis here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
Well, we've saved some time for you to ask each other questions, and I think it's Gloria's turn, if I recall. Do you have a question for Brian Barton?
I would just be interested to know, you've indicated you do have experience in other areas of the law. I know you worked a brief time at Moen Sheehan, but really, have you practiced anything in the civil area of the law?
Yeah, when I was at Moen Sheehan, I practiced in the family law area. I practiced largely in estate planning and probate, criminal defense as well, real estate law, extensive experience in that while I was at Moen Sheehan. And then I also, since leaving the DA's office, I worked at Kaplan and I was in the contract division there. And then I have other experience with regard to civil litigation, civil trials, and civil hearings. So, yeah.
Brian, do you have a question for Gloria?
Yeah, I guess the question would be, what is your experience in the criminal law area?
Well, if you looked into that, you would know that I was on the public defender's list, as many people are when they start out as attorneys. I began practicing in 1987 and was on the public defender's list. I handled both misdemeanors and felonies well on that list, as well as taking private cases as an attorney. I practiced law for 18 years prior to becoming family court commissioner. And so during that time, I had an opportunity to help out members of the community who got into criminal situations, as well as take, you know, people that were my clients, private clients, as well as take cases from the public defender's office for many years during that 18 years that I was in private practice.
Question for Brian, I believe. And this is a question for both of you. You both have questioned each other's qualifications, one on the civil side, one on the criminal side. How important do you think it is for a position like circuit judge to have either the majority of their experience in criminal law or have a broad-based, you know, experience with all types of the law?
Sure. I think it's important that any judge has knowledge and experience in all, you know, pretty much all areas, if at all possible. Our judges do hear all types of cases, but
the fact of the matter is that a large majority of those cases are criminal, and those are the cases they see day in and day out. And the next judge or any judge in La Crosse County needs to know every facet of the criminal law, the procedures and sentencing options, bond options, and so forth. So I do think that the experience in the criminal criminal realm is highly important.
You also feel it's important to have a broad...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well. Same question for you, Gloria.
I think what's probably most important is to have decision-making experience, and I'm the only one of the two candidates who does have that. I've been making decisions from the bench for the last 9 years as family court commissioner and for all five branches of the system in the family law area. Excuse me. And nothing can replace judicial decision-making. Nothing can replace the pressure you're under when you need to make a decision from the bench at that moment. I think that's why I have the support of the prior judges Mulroy, Manaban, Perlich, and Pissell, as well as Judge Rusbro, who is the one who was chief judge when I was appointed as family court commissioner. I think they all understand that I can make a decision, that I can handle difficult issues, and conduct myself with, respect and decorum and integrity.
This is for Gloria Doyle. La Crosse County has a variety of courts like drug courts, OWI courts, a veterans court, and a criminal justice management council to look at the system as a whole. Do you have any ideas for alternative courts that La Crosse County doesn't have right now?
I was talking to a friend of mine who was talking about a mental health court that they have over in the Appleton area, and I found that somewhat intriguing. I don't know right now whether that is an evidence-based court, and I think that that would be important right now to make sure if we started another alternative court that it is evidence-based practices. Certainly at this point we see all the players coming together. Probation and parole is starting to use evidence-based practices. Justice Services is using evidence-based practices, and the judges in sentencing are using evidence-based practices. So if we did start another alternative court, I think it would be important that that also continue that tradition of following evidence-based practices. In other words, making sure the practices are practices that have been shown to be effective through prior study.
Same question for you, Brian.
I think the way that we'll probably go in La Crosse County, and there's been talk for a number of years, is like a mental health type of court. I think there's an increasing push and in need for that. We do have a large population, but a significant amount of our population that does suffer from some type of mental illness. Would hope that that court, or if something like that were to come about, would focus on the intervention early on rather than after it's too late. I think the goal of that type of court, and ideally every court that we have, should focus on the intervention early on before the individual is brought into the criminal justice system.
This question is for Brian, with the Criminal Justice Management Council, how do you see your experience and personality fitting in, not only on that council, but with the other judges? Because I know the judges try to work together.
Yeah, I have a good relationship with all the judges. I was hired by Scott Horn, and I have a good relationship with him in the courtroom. As well as Judge Levine, Judge Bierke, Judge Gonzalez. Each one of those judges brings something unique to the table, and I think that I would also bring unique qualities to the table, and I would work extremely well with those judges in that system to figure out how to best serve Branch 5.
Gloria Doyle, how do you see your personality and experience fitting in with the other judges and the Criminal Justice Management Council?
I think that my personality would fit in fine with all of them. I've worked collaboratively with Judge Levine in the past on domestic violence issues, and I do have his endorsement in this race. The other judges have chosen to not endorse in this race, the other current sitting judges. But I meet with them at least once a month at the judges' meeting and work with them collaboratively on cases that we share and cases that are interrelated, such as they might have the criminal matters and I'm handling the family law matters. So I'm confident that I can work with the other judges when I take the bench. With regard to the Criminal Justice Management Council, I have followed the work of that council and, you know, kept in contact with Jane Claycamp, who's directing the Justice Support Services area. Many of the people on the Domestic Violence Court Committee work in the DA's office and other areas of the system, and so I have a good working relationship with the domestic violence advocates as well as the DA's office and the staff of the judges and other areas of the courthouse.
This is a question for Gloria first. You will be one of five judges in La Crosse County. What does the criminal justice system need? Is there anything different that isn't happening now that you could suggest as a judge that might make the system work a little differently or a little more efficiently or better?
Well, again, sitting in on those judges' meetings, I think that the current judges are constantly taking a look at how they can improve the intake criminal justice system, how they can improve these treatment courts. I know recently they've made some changes to the OWI treatment court that they believe will allow them to better allocate treatment hours to the people that need the services and perhaps less treatment hours to those who are self-correcting and have begin to address their illness. So at this point, I do not see any areas that are glaringly in need of my rescue right when I take the bench. But I certainly look forward to working with the other four judges and taking on my responsibility for whatever areas they feel I can best serve them and work into the mix.
And Brian?
One issue that I've had for a number of years with regard to our criminal justice system in La Crosse is our sentencing practices. I am all for community-based sentences. I'm all for doing the electronic monitoring type of offenses to alleviate the strain on the jail and so forth and overcrowding. But I would like to see a little bit tweaking with that system in that right now, when somebody's sentenced to a jail sentence on electronic monitoring, the public nor law enforcement really knows who's serving those sentences. And I think it's important that the sheriff's department in some way become involved in that. So if there are violations by an individual that's serving a jail sentence, either consuming alcohol or using drugs or going out of range on the electronic monitoring, that that those issues are dealt with immediately. Right now we don't have that, and I think public safety should really dictate that something like that takes place.
This question is for Brian first. We've talked about the criminal versus civil matters that judges must decide, but what in your background allows you to handle a wide variety of cases, medical malpractice, wills, corporate civil cases, even the routine things like picking a jury or ruling on a procedural challenge or, you know, being called on in the middle of the night to execute a search warrant?
From day one, I've been, when I started practicing law, did a lot of different areas. I did real estate, I did estate planning. So I know those laws, those statutes. I know how to deal with contracts. I know how to, being in the prosecutor's office as an assistant and deputy district attorney, I was routinely called on a daily basis, all hours of the night to do those search warrants. So I have worked with judges in getting those search warrants. So I know the procedures for that. I know the standard of proof that's necessary in those types of cases. I've also been a military lawyer in the Army. So I have, different aspects with regard to that. So, I mean, I do have that broad range, wide range of practice areas under my belt, and I do have that extensive criminal law experience that's needed.
Same question for you, Gloria.
Certainly as to those things, I have some experience in the past at picking juries, but not from the bench. There are no juries in family law court. But certainly in terms of hearing witnesses, controlling a courtroom, controlling the demeanor within the courtroom, those are things that I have firsthand experience doing for the last 9 years as family court commissioner. And, according to Brian Zlit, he has 5-plus and 7-plus years of experience in criminal and prosecutorial time, so that's 12-plus by my great math skills. I have 27-plus years of practicing law, and so that in and of itself gives me a plethora of experiences in a variety of different areas that would allow me to take the bench, knowing what needs to be done, and handling all those different areas. Though we talk about criminal being a large portion of the judge's responsibilities, they reach on intake for 2 out of every 10 weeks, and so all those other civil areas, whether it's mental commitments or guardianships, termination of parental rights and adoption, those are things that I have firsthand experience dealing with over the last 27 years.
And we've reached the closing argument stage of the forum, and I believe it's Gloria's turn to go first.
Okay. Some of your questions today had to do with working with other partners in the legal system. So I would first just point out that with regard to Mr. Burton's idea about the Sheriff's Department taking on electronic monitoring and monitoring criminals, that's something that our current sheriff has no interest in doing. So before we start shaking up the system, I think it would be a good idea to make sure that those type of things stay with the people that are interested in doing them. Jane Claycamp has been handling Justice Support Services and doing a good job at those electronic monitoring cases. And the sheriff's been doing a good job at what he's been doing. Those two individuals work well together and don't need that interfered with. As we go forward into this final few days of the election, I just hope people keep in mind that I have the judicial experience, I have the temperament, the integrity, and the decisiveness to be the next judge in Branch 5. And I also have the endorsement of the prior judge, Pasal, as well as other judges to handle Branch 5.
And Brian Barton, your closing statement.
Thank you. If elected to Branch 5, I will do whatever I can to uphold the law in a fair and unbiased manner. I will follow the statutes. I will follow the Constitution to the letter of the law without any personal belief or personal reasons for doing anything different. Every decision that I make will be ground upon public safety. I think public safety is paramount. That's what I hear when I talk to people, that they want somebody focused on public safety. With regard to the jail, the sentencing on electronic monitoring, I believe that the way that we're doing it right now is wrong. A lot of people believe that. Law enforcement believe that that's wrong. The fact that the public in law enforcement doesn't know who is serving a jail sentence is wrong. And just because we've been doing something wrong for a period of time does not make it right. And just because we need to change that doesn't mean we're shaking any trees.
Attorneys Brian Barton and Gloria Doyle, they're candidates for La Crosse County Circuit Court Judge Branch 5. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis was our moderator. The election is Tuesday, April 7th. To hear the audio archive of our candidates' forum, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find links to information about both candidates at our website, where you can also find archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers. And if you'd like to share your comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Coming up, those invading carp, the good, the bad, and some of the ugly truths about how they impact our waterways. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm John Gatto. Carp. The word conjures up a wide variety of reactions, not only among fishermen, but people in general, and specifically cultures around the world. In recent years, carp have been increasingly mentioned among invasive species that are threatening our waterways, and there have been attempts up and down the Mississippi River to help control the most aggressive offenders. But the headlines alone only tell part of the story. So with us to sort out things is Reggie McLeod. He's the publisher of Winona, Minnesota-based Big River Magazine. More importantly, he's been covering the issue for a number of years, reporting on its ups and downs, and along the way working to generate some greater awareness of the issue related to carp. So let's start with the basics. Not all carp are created equal. Help us sort it out.
Well, the common carp has been in this area since the late 1800s. Actually, it moved through Europe because it was such an easy fish to farm in ponds. It was deliberately moved all the way out to England, and it's a very popular fish for anglers in England. Then it was brought deliberately to this country and planted and got established here. So it's been around. It's almost a naturalized citizen, I suppose, but it's still not a good thing for the environment. It kind of takes advantage of environmental degradation. Hmm. It can cope with that well, which means it's pretty successful generally. What they call Asian carp now, and they're all Asian carp technically, are new ones that were brought into this country to help with fish farming in the south. They were used to eat plants and pests and so on. And of course, the fish farmers promised that they would never escape. And of course they did, and got into the lower Mississippi. And ever since then, they've been spreading farther up the Mississippi and through the Mississippi watershed. And of course, the big controversy recently has been, how can we keep them out of the Great Lakes? Because that's another huge watershed.
We hear about Asian carp in general, but we hear silver carp. Mm-hmm. That's just one of a couple of different varieties that are more recent invasives.
Yeah, the Asian carp generally refer to four carp. The ones that we're worried about the most and that are spreading the most aggressively are silver carp, which are the ones that jump, the famous ones that jump way up in the air, and bighead carp. But there are also black carp and grass carp that are spreading.
And what are we seeing in these here parts? What are we most concerned with?
Well, they've found silver carp and bighead carp in our stretch of the Mississippi as far back as 2008. And they don't find them there every year, but they found them on occasion, and they found them up as far as just below the Twin Cities, getting into the Twin Cities area.
What is it about these non-native invasive carp that threaten the waterways, that threaten aquatic life? Why be concerned?
Well, because they displace native fish, I guess, is the main concern. They're displacing game fish. But not everyone agrees with that, because some people believe that if you have a healthy ecosystem, that it's more difficult for invasives to get established. So some people believe that the reason that these new Asian carp haven't spread to this area in large numbers is because we have a healthier river up here, and that it's more difficult. Other people say, no, it's just going to take more time. Mm-hmm. But the place where they're most common, when you see those YouTube videos of the jumping silver carp, that's usually in the lower Illinois River. And that river has been very degraded because there's sewage from the Chicago area that goes into that river. And the ecosystem in that river collapsed in the 1950s and the early 1960s. So perhaps that was an opportunity for the Asian carp to move in, because there was an empty niche for them to occupy.
You mentioned that there has been monitoring that's shown some of these invasives back to 2008 here in the upper Mississippi. At what point were they really moving up the river itself? I mean, has this been going on for decades now?
Yeah, it's almost 30 years, close to 30 years since they escaped. So it has been a slow process, and some people would argue that eventually we'll have a lot of them up here and they'll displace the native fish. It's hard to say. They eat a lot of the same things that the young game fish would eat. So if there's more silver carp and bighead carp, there'll be fewer game fish.
What is being done currently to try and curb that expansion, either in population or further up the river?
Not much. We've Congress did instruct the Army Corps of Engineers to close the lock at the Upper St. Anthony Falls lock and dam, which is in downtown Minneapolis. And that was done to keep the fish from getting into the Mississippi River above the Twin Cities and to protect that whole watershed from carp. And that's going to be done on June 10th, I believe. It's closed probably right now, and the Corps decided to open it this spring, which a lot of people objected to because the point was to block the carp, and the carp and most fish tend to migrate in the spring. So opening it in the spring, if only for a few months, is probably a pretty bad idea. But after that, that'll be closed, and there'll be a waterfall that's almost 50 feet high. It'll be a pretty good barrier for the fish. But really,
and again, that's designed to keep them from moving into the headwaters and further north.
And there's a lot of big lakes that drain into the Mississippi River, and they could move up into all those lakes.
So, and these invasives have not been found at that point yet.
No, they haven't. They've been found a few miles below there.
Mm-hmm.
And they found
in the Twin Cities.
The Twin Cities. And they found some DNA evidence, but it's pretty unlikely that they're above there now.
What about closer to our neck of the woods then? You said there's really not much being done. What's possible?
I don't know if there's anything possible. People are looking at, they've looked at poisons that might be specific to one fish, but that's very dangerous because there are so many different types of fish and other animals in the water that could be affected by a poison. They've looked at diseases that might hold them in check. They've looked at sound barriers and electrical barriers in the locks and dams, but that may not be very effective because when the river gets to a certain height, the Army Corps of Engineers is required to pull all of the gates up out of the water in the dams and let the water flow freely. So there's no barrier there. So there's a good chance that they could swim right through those dams when the gates are out of the water.
For those who are concerned, professionals who are concerned about the advancement of the Asian carp through the Mississippi and presumably into some of its tributaries, what will they be looking for as far as the negative effect of this happening and over what span of time? I mean, is this the next 10 years, the next 50 years, and what's it going to look like?
I don't think they know, and I think most biologists would tell you as much because you might think that all you need is a male and a female of a certain species to be in a certain place and create a population there. Mm-hmm. And that might be true for Asian carp. And maybe you need dozens to really have a sustainable population. I don't think they really know. They're kind of learning as they go. One thing that we've just discovered, and I'm kind of giving away something that's going to be in the next magazine, but it appears that there are fewer common carp in the river, and people aren't sure what the reason for that is. There's a chance that that could be some kind of disease. It could be something that would affect the other Asian carp as well. If that's the case, it could be, again, that the ecosystem is healthier, and maybe that's discouraging it. I think it was about four summers ago, there was all this weed growth in the river.
Right.
And it drove
people
crazy because the backwaters are just clogged with weeds. You couldn't fish. I couldn't get into some backwaters. I almost had to drag my canoe over the weeds. They were so thick. And as inconvenient as that was for us human beings, it was really a big payday for fish, I believe. That provided a lot of cover for young fish, so their survival rate was probably better. There was a lot of food. So that might have been a sign that in some ways the river was getting healthier and maybe that affected the common carp. But it's a very complex system and there's a surprising amount of that we don't really understand about it yet.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. We're talking with Reggie McLeod, publisher of Big River Magazine and its online complement, bigrivermagazine.com. And we're talking about carp. So if the biologists and others who are monitoring the situation aren't sure what it's going to look like or how quickly things might change, why the red flags all the time? I mean, why has this become such a big deal?
Well, because people value a healthy ecosystem with the variety and the native fish in it, and they don't have that in the Illinois River. Almost the entire fish mass in sections of the Illinois River are just silver and bighead carp. There are no other fish. There are no other species. And there were some before, so they've mm-hmm. displaced them. And so everyone fears that our stretch of the river, other stretches of the river are going to look like that eventually.
Yeah.
I mean, they really might.
One of the things that Big River Magazine has done and others, but in particular, you've kind of led this cause, it seems, to raise awareness, not only of the issue, but of the fact that carp in some cultures and in some parts of the world have usefulness. They're not just nuisance fish. Retrace that for us a little bit. And why did you, as a publisher of a magazine, an extension of your work as a journalist, why did you choose to try and create more awareness?
Well, it's interesting. In a lot of parts of the world, there have some species of fish face extinction. And there were some hugely productive fisheries, like the cod fishery in the North Atlantic, that have been destroyed, not by pollution or environmental degradation, just by overfishing. And there are fish species in the Caribbean and all around the world that are having to be protected because of overfishing. Whereas at the same time, common carp still is a problem, as well as these new species of Asian carp. And they're also the most popular freshwater fish for consumption in the world. There's
wow.
a tremendous volume of carp eaten in Asia and Africa and Europe. It's extremely important. When I was in high school on the north of Detroit in the suburbs, about half of my friends were the children of people who had left Poland after World War II. So I had a lot of Polish friends and Ukrainian friends and so on. And the Christmas tradition in Poland and much of Germany and even into Ukraine is Christmas dinner, you serve a baked carp. And I had been raised, and my father always told me that carp was inedible. If we were out fishing and we caught a carp, we'd try to give it away, or he'd bring it home and bury it under the rose bushes or something like that. He thought people that ate carp just didn't know any better. Huh. And of course, the people who were eating the carp thought the people who didn't eat the carp didn't know any better. And the numbers really support their side of the argument. So we thought, perhaps at least one way to slow the spread and maybe take care of this problem would be to help make eating carp more popular, to connect people up with this tradition, and maybe we can overfish the carp. And commercial fishermen, there's still a lot of commercial fishermen on the river. There are fewer than there were 20 mm-hmm. or 30 years mm-hmm. ago. And there were small fish stores in most towns that were often owned by a commercial fisherman. There was one in Winona, Raymer's. Bud Raymer owned that, and he caught the fish, and he was selling pickled carp, like pickled herring,
yeah.
which were really good.
Huh.
And I'd go in and buy
Amazing.
Them, and he pickled them himself. And I had a party at my home one time, and I had a bowl of pickled carp, and I had a bowl of pickled herring, a good brand that you would be familiar with, side by side. And I told my guests, well, I got these two brands of pickled herring, and Pam and I don't agree on which one tastes best. Taste these and let me know which you'd like the most.
Oh,
and
boy.
Hands down.
Totally duped everybody.
The carp was more popular.
Hands down, really.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Some people weren't happy when I told them about
sure.
that. But,
well, I suspect that was some of the impetus for your first go-around in trying to raise some awareness of carp as edible, trying to get some restaurants to put it on the menu.
Yeah, it was a contest. We offered prizes of free advertising and publicity and so on to a restaurant that would serve the best carp dish. And there's a lot of good restaurants in these river, in our river towns here.
And we're talking the spans between the Twin Cities and the Quad Cities,
yes.
Right? I mean, it's
yes.
not just La Crosse or Winona. You were looking...
400 miles of the river, dozens of towns.
Lots of restaurants.
Lots of good restaurants.
Okay.
And we really beat the drum and publicized this. We had stories, actually, we had people from Radio Free China call me and interview me about this because mm-hmm. people in China think it's so funny that people don't eat carp in this country. And for the first 2 years, we didn't have a single entry. There wasn't a single restaurant in that 400 miles of river that would serve carp. Then in the third year, we had two of them. One was the Bluegill Cafe in McGregor, which mm-hmm. was a new restaurant at the time, and Mississippi's Bistro in Trempealeau, Wisconsin. I had the carp numerous times at both places, and it was very good, and other people that ate it enjoyed it.
Uh-huh.
And both of those restaurants are out of business now.
Not related to the carp, though.
Let's hope not. I don't think so.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that eventually there'll be a lot of restaurants serving carp. I hear places in Chicago and other parts in the country. There's a place in Keokuk, Iowa, mm-hmm. that served carp for years. There's a place in Omaha that's been in business since the 20s or 30s.
Wow. But they're few and far between.
Yeah, I mean, those are the only two places I know of that have been serving carp for a long time and are pretty popular restaurants, I guess.
So that brings us up to the here and now and your current contest, current way of creating awareness is having people write poetry about it.
It's interesting because carp are a subject of art and poetry in Asia too, and people don't mm-hmm. realize that. And when I first got the idea of the poetry contest, I, of course, Googled carp and poetry, which any modern person would want to do. And I found a beautiful poem by a Chinese woman, Yun Wang, who, besides being a poet, is an astrophysicist and cosmologist at the University of Oklahoma. And there is a tradition of carp and poetry. Besides that, this is a contemporary poem, but, mm-hmm. but there are older ones. So we have prizes in three categories, which is free form, haiku, and limericks. As,
okay.
You know, there once was a carp in La Crosse, that sort of thing.
Sure.
And the subjects, I kind of flipped through I didn't think it would be fair to read any of the entrants here for the radio because the contest is still going on. But there's a lot of use of the verb carping, as to carp about something.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of attention to eating carp and a lot of things about whiskers, too, because they do have some distinctive whiskers.
Your intent for this is to just simply create awareness.
Yeah, I want people to think about it.
The good they might provide, but also the awareness of carp as a invasive problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Be knowledgeable.
Well, I'd still like to see them eaten. I think they're a resource. It's unusual to have a resource that harvesting that resource creates a benefit. Usually you have to protect things or limit the harvest, whether it's trees or fish or birds or anything. And in the case with carp, if they're over-harvested, I think a lot of people would be happy about that.
We've mentioned a couple of times that carp have, in the past, been more available in fish markets especially. Where do we find it today?
There are still some commercial fishermen with stores. The one near here is Mike Valley has a store in Prairie du Chien, and he's a fisherman and does a good job of smoking carp. A lot of the major chain supermarkets have smoked carp if you look for it. I've bought it at Woodman's and some other stores. We just did something in the current Big River about some of the supermarket chains. Hy-Vee has a difficult time. They used to sell smoked carp and they stopped because that wasn't approved by groups that were approving the sustainability of fish harvests. And again, that's ironic because we want people to over-harvest carp, but because it wasn't certified, they can't sell it anymore. So that might be a problem with some stores, but it's still around.
Yeah.
And it's really sad that when we have such an abundance of a resource like that, that we don't eat it. You know, people have a lot of food prejudices, and it wasn't that long ago in this country that people didn't eat lobsters and shrimp because, and rightly so, they were considered to be a bug. They're much more closely related to insects and spiders than they are to fish. They are basically a bug. So it's just a matter of attitude and culture. And I wish my father were still around because I would like to sit down with some crackers and some good smoked carp and have him enjoy it because he's the guy that got me going on the wrong track with these carp.
Reggie McLeod tracks and reports on issues related to the Mississippi River and is publisher of the Winona, Minnesota-based Big River Magazine. You'll find links to the magazine, the current Carp Poetry Contest, which has a submission deadline of May 1st, and Young Lang's poem, The Carp, all at our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. The winning entries in that Carp Poetry Contest, by the way, will be published in the July-August issue of the magazine. If you missed part of today's show, you can also find the audio archives for this and other Newsmakers programs at wpr.org/newsmakers. Visit it often. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Our production team includes Maureen McCollum, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. A reminder that for updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.